So Tom, it's true that lots of IFR flying occurred before we even had in cockpit weather. And I know you have your share of experience with that. My question is that, you know, surely we've used some of that technology to increase utility and actually take on flights that we wouldn't have prior to having the technology. And I'm wondering if this is a situation like that, would you have launched on this flight in, say, 1995?
Yeah, I probably would, because you know, back in those days, that's the kind of flying we did. We didn't know any different. We managed to get around the country pretty well, and that was before we even had as good a radar coming, radar advisories coming from air traffic control as we have today. We did have Flight Watch, which they had pretty decent weather. You could call Flight Watch and get some good guidance, but even then it was sort of general. They didn't have your route exactly in front of you, or at least plotted on a screen. Yeah, it was kind of a way of life, and we, for the most part, got there. There were a lot of skirmish moments in the cockpit, for sure, but again, we didn't know any different. And so I've often said that one of the things that has increased the utility of general aviation more than just about anything I can think of, except maybe GPS, is in-cockpit weather. Because I know I've made flights that I wouldn't have otherwise have made because I had that level of situational awareness. In this case, we lost it in the middle. And if you were to ask me, would I make this flight from the beginning without NEXRAD, I probably would, but I'd be, again, sort of defaulting back to some kind of a mindset like we used to have, which was, you know, we go blundering along and we use what we have available to us, which in this case would be air traffic control and maybe a call to flight service, because flight service can help you today. It's just not a dedicated flight watch frequency.
So, yeah, another thing that came up is this pilot, when he encounters this failure, he gets that uncomfortable feeling. He's uneasy about, you know, having to use only center for help avoiding these storms. How do you decide when you're getting that uncomfortable feeling, whether it's because it's unsafe or it's just different? Kevin?
For me, the big difference between those would be what is my plan and what is my plan B and how am I going to get out of this situation? If I don't have solid answers for those, I want to maybe consider turning around, maybe consider landing, because anytime you're, especially when you're tangling with weather, you always want to have your out.
Doug?
I tend to kind of listen to what's going on inside. And part of that goes back, I remember many years ago, flying a Malibu Mirage. I was up at 19,000 feet coming up the East Coast. I was about 50 miles offshore and was going to go into a cirrus layer. And I just felt really, really queasy about it. And I couldn't explain why. And shortly after I went into the clouds, I had a turbocharger failure. And I realized why I felt queasy. Now, was I just being psychic? I don't really know. But that lesson certainly taught me, for me personally, to listen to what's going on inside and to respect it.
Why?
Well, I just want to tag on a little bit to what Doug said. And to your question, Ryan, I get apprehensive often when things aren't going the way I expected them to. And I don't think that means it's unsafe. It just means that I'm maybe on higher alert and paying attention a little more, or maybe making a bit of a more conservative decision to try to get things back to get me comfortable. So I think that uneasy feeling is a good thing for pilots to have and to respond to, by the way.
Yeah. So going around the table then, did anybody have a different plan here than Tom? Wally?
Well, sorry to be back again, but being from the era even before Tom, when he was probably 3 years old, my choice in this scenario would be go low, descend, get VFR, stay under the clouds. Yeah, Tom's solution is good as long as ATC can help you and you don't blunder into something. Certainly, that's good. But if you look at the maximum elevation figures along that route on the VFR sectional, you're really clear. You don't have any issues with high terrain until you get clear out to the end, past Sturgis. And if you had a problem at Sturgis, you could always land and rent a motorcycle, I'm sure, to finish the rest of the trip. So it's flat land. It's flat as a pancake out there. You're going to see the big thunderstorms by those heavy rain shafts, which you can very easily go around. You can still get help from ATC, probably, depending on how high you are. So for me, that's the more comfortable choice.
So the rest of you then are going at 10,000 feet, is that right?
No, I'm probably, this is Bruce, I'm probably with Wally on that. I would, having flown out there a bit in the Midwest, I probably would have gone low. And one thing that we haven't really talked about is the fact that this line of weather, you know, the whole trip is going to take about 2 hours, but getting through that that line of weather is only about an hour, it looks like. So you're going to be down low for a while, and yeah, you're going to get bounced around a bit, but it's not the whole trip. You're going to be on the other side of it. So I would probably have chosen to go low and go visual.
Wally.
Good point about getting bounced around. I'd just like to add, now Scott may disagree with me, and I'd be interested to hear his view of this, but in looking at the METARs across there, the winds are all very light at all of those stations. There's really no terrain to create turbulence. There's overcast skies, so I don't think we're going to have a lot of thermal turbulence, so I don't really expect it to be that bumpy.
I saw Scott, saw you shaking your head, so now we get to hear why the meteorologist thinks we're all wrong, right?
Well, I mean, there's unfortunately, there's lots of problems with just about all the responses except for, you know, getting down and landing, to me. I would never go lower. The problem is that, you know, when you start to try to work your way under some of these cells, you never know when you're going to get to the point where you get a nice downdraft. Even if you had data link weather, you know, operational, you don't want to get yourself into that kind of convective wind shear. You know, convection or turbulence that occurs as a result of convection doesn't have to be because of strong winds. Straight down air that comes down from the core of the cell could potentially, you know, take you out. And then altitude is always your friend. You have to make sure that, you know, you've got some altitude to deal with, because if you got 15 feet to recover from, you know, something like that, that's really dangerous. I try to keep my rule of thumb in this situation is to keep blue sky above me. If I can't do that, I'm not making the trip, period. And 10,000 feet in IMC scares the heck out of me, even with data link weather. I want to be able to visually see and separate myself, no different than separating yourself from aircraft. You know, if you're in the clouds with other aircraft, that scares the heck out of me as well, but that's even more so with weather.
Doug.
I've got to say about going on top and always seeing blue out in front of you, I think in Tom's situation here, he's got a turbo normalized Bonanza, so he can get up high, although he is somewhat limited. But for all the rest of us who don't have the ability or the opportunity to fly a turbo normalized or a turbocharged aircraft, sometimes getting on top can be a ticket to a fast ride back down as those tops slowly keep climbing and we're dealing with icing. And now all of a sudden you're stuck on top, and how do you get down? Whereas if I'm going underneath, I can always find somewhere to bail out and land. You're up on top of this stuff, perhaps with an airplane that is not certified for flight in known ice, getting higher and higher. You can't climb anymore. You're stuck between a rock and a hard spot, so to speak.
Bruce.
Well, I've heard Scott, I'd like his opinion on this. I've heard Scott talk frequently about the fact that you don't have to have, you know, lightning to have convection. If you've got heavy showers, that's a clue that there's convection going on. And so if you could expand on that a little bit, Scott, I think that might be helpful.
Yeah, sure, Bruce. The thing is, what most pilots don't understand is they look at lightning as being the de facto standard for convection. Really, it's not. Lightning is just one side effect of the convective process that's in place. What do you call something 1 second before the first lightning strike? Well, it's called a rain shower. In showery precipitation, you can have even tornadic situations without lightning. So you can't necessarily just use lightning as your predictor here for convective turbulence. So anytime you get vertically developed clouds along that route of flight, those are generated through a mixing process, meaning turbulence. And as a result of that, you can get some pretty significant turbulence in those clouds. Now, every weather situation is different. Certainly, there will be times where you can probably fly smoothly through a lot of this stuff. But in other cases, you just don't know. And the best thing is really avoidance. And the way you avoid this stuff is either by looking at like a data link radar depiction or visually.
So visually on top isn't really an option because of the oxygen situation, possibly because of ice near the cloud tops, freezing levels around 15. What if the tops were at 15? Does that change it for anybody? Scott?
Yeah, I think that would change it for me, because I like to fly higher. My goal is to visually inspect everything out there. I can see where my enemies are ahead of me, and I can avoid them fairly easily. Now, if they're higher buildups, sometimes in a convective process, you may have to deviate around those. But in general, you can visually see where those, you know, mountains in the sky are, and you don't fly into them. If you're an IMC, you have no way of doing that. I can tell you, I've got tons and tons of stories people have confided in me for flying into showery precipitation and almost killing themselves. So that's something I see a lot. And it's all because of the fact is, and I go back to the, you know, your pre-flight planning, that's all something that you should uncover in the big weather picture and understand that. You shouldn't be making a trip without understanding that big weather picture. And if you don't, then you're going to eventually find yourself in a bad situation.
Tom and then Wally.
If the tops were 15,000, I had a turbocharged airplane, I'd probably go for that. I mean, you might have to deviate quite a ways around some of the larger buildups, but if you got lots of fuel, it's only a 2-hour flight. Assume you got lots of fuel on board, be a little longer than 2-hour flight up at altitude with those kind of winds. But still, I think that's a reasonable option there.
I agree. If the tops were 15 and icing wasn't an issue to get there, clearly that would change my view on it.
It sounds like sometimes just rain showers are an issue. Sometimes they're not. You know, do you guys have any rules for what is okay to fly through on the radar and what isn't? I know I ask this to, you know, like on instrument stage checks a lot, and I get something like, well, I won't fly through the yellow. Okay. And then we dig into it a little more, and there's a little more to that. Sometimes that's too conservative, and sometimes you shouldn't even be in the green. And what does the yellow and the green even mean? So do you guys have any rules for what you will and won't fly through? Kevin?
For me, it depends a whole lot on what's going on with the weather. And I'll come at this from an air traffic controller standpoint for just a moment. There's been plenty of times where I'm vectoring airplanes around a whole bunch of air carriers. These are airplanes with significant capability with what they can fly through and their ability to detect precipitation with their onboard radar. There's plenty of times where it'll be more widespread areas of really heavy precipitation where it'll show up as the highest levels of precipitation. And we're vectoring around an approach control airspace at say 6,000 feet. And it is just silky smooth flying through the heavy precip. In those sort of situations, I think the most important thing is PIREPs. So if I've got a whole bunch of good PIREPs of smooth ride or just occasional light turbulence type of a thing through the heavy precip, and I'm able to confirm that those PIREPs are from that heavy precip, then I feel pretty good about washing the airplane.
Doug?
For me, it depends on what kind of NexRad radar we have. Certainly, although ADS-B is getting better, the amount of resolution is nowhere near as great as XM. I have numerous screenshots of my iPad showing ADS-B and the XM on the G1000. And my airplane icon is right in the middle of the yellow or sometimes even red of the ADS-B and then yellow or green on the XM. So part of my answer depends on what I am using. Jeff Van West and I once had a discussion where looking at the two different pictions, ADS-B and XM, a question on which way to go to deviate around weather. And one display said go to the left, the other display said go to the right. So for me, it depends. And I spend the extra money to get XM on board for myself. And even in XM, there are many times, and again, it depends what the system is, but there are many times, as Kevin has said, like just last week, we flew about 80 miles in yellow with hardly a bump.
Yeah, my understanding is there's no standard for what DBZ level yellow starts at, for example. It's all pretty close, but it varies from system to system, so you can get some disagreement between the two. Bruce?
One other question, though, that came up for me in looking at the scenario was how rapidly is this weather developing? We're in July, we're in the Midwest. And so it really made the choice, you know, kind of tough, because if you go high and try to poke your way through, are these clouds, you know, going to build up faster than I can climb or faster than I can avoid them? And then getting back to Scott's point earlier, if you do go low, you might find yourself flying underneath a cell that wasn't there, you know, 10 minutes ago and get some significant downdrafts. This gets really back to the pre-flight planning, and I have to say I was a bit nervous reading the whole setup in the sense that there's a lot of sentences in there that suggest get there-itis. You know, I'm at the end of the day, gone to this meeting, I want to meet up with my family, we're on vacation, I'm going to press on. Why not wait a day and go in the morning, the next morning, when it's not going to be so stressful?
Scott?
Going back to the question that about what color is safe to fly through, I'll, you know, just reiterate the fact that, yes, every single system that you use has different colors. There's no standard unless you're going with a onboard radar where they do have standards for that. You know, it's it really depends on that big weather picture that you look at. If there's a convective potential threat, if you look at convective outlooks or there's a convective signets in the area, such like that, it's probably more convectively driven. Showery precipitation is a good indication. So if you're looking at TAFs along the route, look for that as well. If it's not convectively driven, because the reflectivity that you see in the cockpit is basically, or on the ground in the NEXRAD depiction, is based on the size of the droplets or drops that you're seeing, or it could also be drop density. So you can have a situation where you have lots and lots of smaller drops and be in the red and it be smooth. Or you can get in thunderstorms, larger drop sizes because of the updrafts. And there, you know, even though that it may be the same amount of liquid water in the cloud, the drops are, the size of the drops are the key to raising that reflectivity up in terms of the actual numbers. So that's where you end up in a situation where larger drops are going to be, you know, reds and purples.
Doug?
To go into something that Tom kind of finished up his response with, goes back to using ATC for help and the question of radar as well, onboard radar. I've long remembered a flight I was doing. We were coming up from Titusville trying to get to St. Simons, Georgia, and there was a squall line going on. And using the radar, I had kind of made the decision, this isn't going to work. We're not going to get to St. Simons, and we divert to St. Augustine. But talking to, I can't remember who I was, whether I think it was Daytona, and they said, well, you know, we see a real big hole here, and if you're willing to make a turn slightly back southwest, I can take you through this, bring you up the backside of the line, and you'll make it to St. Simons. And I looked at my client to make sure a client was going to be comfortable with that. They nodded their head yes. We did it and had a wonderful flight. So often it seems that we're reluctant now to use ATC's help. And I know it depends certainly somewhat on the controller and the controller's experience. And a lot of the really experienced fellows are leaving now because of mandatory early retirement. But still, ATC can be such a valuable resource. And I never hesitate to ask.
Yeah, Doug, I've had similar experiences too. One that comes to mind, I was coming up from New Hampshire area back here to Frederick, Maryland, and up near Harrisburg, between here and Harrisburg, there was quite a bit of weather, and I was about ready to throw in the towel and land in Lancaster or someplace and wait and see what happens. And the controller gave me some advice about, well, turn here instead of there and do this instead of that, and you should be fine. And I did, and I was. It was not a big deal. And I've had that many times where ATC has stepped in, or you know, or I've asked in some cases for some advice. And as I said in the response, they're always willing to help. And I can remember only one time many years ago where I got steered wrong by ATC, and that was before we had NEXRAD in the cockpit and that sort of thing. And I found myself in a thunderstorm, which was no fun at all. But have many, many times when it has been helpful.
Scott?
You know, from an air traffic control standpoint, we have to remember they can't see what we see outside the cockpit. They can't see clouds. They can see what's on the radar, but we know that in some cases you can get some pretty healthy convective turbulence in clouds that are not producing any precipitation whatsoever. You have to remember that, you know, if they head you towards something you don't like and it looks pretty ominous, that's not a time to be trying to see you know, just how much you can be bounced around. And the last thing I'll mention is, it was mentioned in the scenario that the icing is not likely at like minus 24 degrees. There's a couple of points here. Number one, never, ever, 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 can I say that ever again, use the standard lapse rate to predict anything, because most of the time the atmosphere is not, you know, is not standard. So we, especially in a convective environment. The other thing is that minus 24 in convection is actually a pretty darn good temperature for icing. It can go down to as much as minus 35 in some cases we've seen. So minus 24 is kind of the sweet spot in convective icing.
Yeah, Kevin.
Just to build a little bit on what Scott was saying, and I completely agree with what he was saying about that, air traffic control for the most part is going to do the best they can with the tools that they have to get you around weather, especially if you're asking for help. And in this scenario, the pilot's asking for help. But one of the things Scott talked about is what ATC can see. And ATC has the ability to see precipitation, but they have no way of determining where turbulence is beyond PIREPS or experience in looking at what radar often translates into turbulence. But they can't see cloud buildups. Clouds don't show up on ATC radar. So if you see a tall buildup that's a cloud that doesn't necessarily have a whole lot of precipitation in it yet, then that's definitely on you as a pilot to recognize that and ask ATC for a deviation that might be different than what ATC had in mind. Because as a pilot, you're the one out there that's flying in it, and you need to really have the ultimate ownership of where you're taking your airplane.
Yeah, I think knowing the strengths and weaknesses of each part of equipment that you have, including the resource that you have to use in ATC, is a big part of what the scenario is. Because if you're counting on something for your flight plan, you have to know what you're going to do if you lose it. You know, in this case, maybe we can ask ATC, we can tell ATC that we lost data link and maybe they'll put more attention on you. But knowing your own equipment's limits is going to help you make smart decisions on when to press on, when to turn back, maybe when to change the plan.